Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust, Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to pick up again our explorations into the cultures of consciousness after a couple of weeks off for the holidays. And I was thinking back about a year ago, a very good friend of mine, a very serious yoga and spiritual practitioner, had a, well, I guess you could call it a brain event, something aneurysm-like. It was very shocking because he was certainly the healthiest person that I knew in my barely, not quite middle age zone. But what was most interesting about this whole thing, which was, of course, very frightening to us, he lost a lot of brain function, and then over the next year, he sort of slowly crawled back until more or less coming back, but not quite the same person, was sort of seeing someone go through a very profound trauma to their cognitive functioning, their personality, their memory, their ability to deal with information, to make decisions, all these kinds of things. But having it happen to somebody who also was a very deep thinker and someone who was very spiritual in his outlook on life, and seeing those things kind of move into one another, and really watching him kind of make meaning from his process and coming to terms with the way in which the fact that we're also, you know, animals that have things happen to our bodies that have these extraordinary effects on these mind streams that we identify ourselves with is a process that's at once physical and spiritual, because, well, maybe there's no real difference between the two in the end. But regardless of that, the way in which trauma is bound up with the spiritual, I think, is a very, very profound question that we often sort of ignore in the modern world, either from the scientific perspective or the sort of so-called spiritual perspective. From the spiritual perspective, people imagine that spiritual transformation occurs through this kind of opening to light and love, and you know, yes, you may have to overcome some difficulties, but I think there's a tendency not to see the way in which extraordinary experiences, near-death experiences, encounters with entities, profound states of insight, of understanding, that they often happen inside the context of traumatic experiences, car crashes, bad drug experiences, neurological events, terrible personal suffering, and that indeed the sort of loops between trauma and spirit are much more profound than I think we often give them credit for. And I've been thinking these things partly because our guest today, the Kentucky artist Dan Rama, has a very, very interesting story of brain trauma, physical experience, and art and spirit, which we'll get to in just a moment. But first we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Maja, welcome back after a couple week break.
Hi, Eric. Thanks. It's great to be back.
I got to say, I saw that image of you in Los Angeles Magazine, that kind of one-page interview. It was a pretty striking photograph. You look very, you look very witchy.
Oh, thanks. I think I also kind of look a little like a superhero, which I was very pleased with.
Yeah, you're doing something really interesting with your hands, because, you know, I think of you as a very smiley person. I mean, anybody listening to the show would probably have a similar sense of you, because you have this very delightful sense of humor and you have a very winning smile. But in this photograph, I expected it to be kind of like a you know, a happy, goofy photograph, but instead there's sort of a, like you say, like a supernatural power vibe going on with your hair and everything. So that was pretty amusing.
Yeah, they had a fan because they heard about my hair. So it looks pretty Stevie Nicks-y. I think I channeled my Mars and Scorpio for that one.
Yeah, well, you're keeping that the sort of the L.A. witch vibe going in particular. So how did you think that the interview came out? I mean, sometimes when people with whatever, you know, spiritual or other sorts of interests get interviewed by the mainstream press, they wind up being very disappointed by how it sort of cutified or made more gently mocked. Were you happy with how it turned out?
Well, there was some pluses and minuses. I mean, I made a statement about being a hermaphroditist instead of a feminist they put in there, which I was pretty pleased with, because usually they would cut that sort of thing out. But then they like talked about the Eagles song Witchy Woman, and I was like, that doesn't have anything to do with me. It's like if you talk about black people, you have to say Michael Jordan or something. I don't know. I couldn't understand why they stuck that in there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I just got to ask this because I've never heard the phrase. So when you say you're a hermaphroditist instead of a feminist, what does that mean?
Yeah, I kind of made it up. But, I mean, I say it because a lot of people think that a witch has to be a woman. And then, of course, a lot of the Wiccans are feminists, and they're trying to, like, you know, kind of do this whole, we're coming into a feminist age and everything's going back to the mother. But I think that's kind of not so great. I think that everything has to be an equal balance between male and female, and until we kind of get that realization, we're not really going to make much progress.
And even farther than that, I mean, there's a lot of pagans now who kind of even see that balance of male and female to itself be a little bit old school and unhelpful. And I think over the last couple decades, we've really seen the sort of queering of paganism, where even the polarity of male and female gets sort of mixed into a larger zone of different kinds of gender identifications and a different kind of like polytheistic world of gender. So it's it's a very interesting one. We should get somebody on the show sometime and talk about that.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good idea.
But today I just want to welcome Dan to the show. Dan, thanks for being with us on Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I just met you because I got a little email, and I love it when I get, you know, emails out of the blue about, you know, things for the show. And most of the time I can tell within about 2 seconds that they're not for me. But I was really intrigued by your story and your work. And I want to let people know right off the bat that they can go to your website, danrhema.com, and, you know, check out some of your artwork. So if we're talking people are going, well, yeah, this sounds great, but I'd like to see something, then you can see it on danrhema.com. But, you know, since you do have this incredible story, I'm just going to, like, give you the floor right now and sort of talk a little bit about how this fascinating route through which you became an artist and the kind of intense experience you went through.
Okay, that sounds good. That's good to have an opportunity to do that. It's definitely not the recommended route to becoming an artist. I'll get that out of the way right up front. But my wife Susan and I, we did international development work. We had worked in Africa, worked in South America. And when we were working in Mexico, we got caught up in an epidemic of dengue fever. And for those that aren't familiar with that, dengue is a mosquito-borne brain infection. Having been in Africa, and we had malaria, we've had dysentery, typical tropical diseases and stuff. But when we got dengue, we knew this was really something special. And at one point, my daughter came into my room and said, you know, Mom and Dad, there's blood all over my room. And so, you know, Susan and I jumped out of bed and ran in there, and there was nothing there, but she was convinced that her room was full of blood. And a couple days later, I was to find out that was like the precursor of when dengue was starting to come through your system. You would have these night terrors, and you know, well above like a nightmare. And at that point, I was lying on my bed trying to hold my head together because I thought it was actually coming apart in the middle. And so we knew we were in trouble, so we started driving out of Mexico. It was a 2-day journey, and Susan came down with the fever. And when you start getting the fever, you start hallucinating and getting delusional. So whichever one of us wasn't hallucinating, that person would drive. And we got across the border into Texas, and I took a real turn for the worse. And we had, over the years, had a relationship with the CDC-related hospitals in Atlanta, Georgia. And we called them, and they said, get him in a cab and get him to the airport and get him right here. So Susan put me in a cab, and that was the last time. By the time I got to the CDC-related hospital up in Atlanta, I couldn't speak. My teeth were chattering. They put me in an infectious room, disease room, so, you know, real isolated. I became photosensitive. They had to turn all the lights down in the room. And then the fever really started spiking. And what I didn't know was that at that time was that I had contracted three separate strains of dengue. And with each strain, it gets exponentially worse. And I had what ended up being meningoencephalitis. My brain was infected, and my spinal cord was infected. And the other name for dengue, bone fever, because one of the symptoms is that everything becomes hypersensitive, and so every touch feels like you're being hit by a hammer, and when you move your hands, it actually feels like you're breaking your joints. And so I'm lying there, and I believe that there's this person on my left side hitting me with a hammer, and I have no clue as to why she's doing this. And she just keeps hitting me and hitting me, and I'm telling her, you know, I don't know what you want. I don't know anything. And then another woman came onto the other side, and I thought she was skinning me alive. I thought she was peeling my skin off my hand. And so I'm just, you know, freaking out, totally freaking out, having this horrible torture, you know, delusion.
But what were the entities like? Were these women? Did you have a sense of them, or was it just like a unknown body?
Well, it was an unknown body because it was dark in the room.
Right, right.
And by that time, I was completely into a delusion. So, and I had no idea where I was, what I was doing. And I came to find out later, the next day, the one woman was putting an IV in my one arm, and so she was tapping my wrist to put an IV in to try to find a vein. And then the other woman, the nurse, was trying to calm me down by stroking my hand. And so, you know, so I'm just having this horrible, horrible, horrible experience. And then they rolled me over to do a spinal. And evidently that's, you know, pretty painful all by itself. And when the doctor came around and he stuck the needle in my back, I shot up out of my body, and I was up in the corner of the room looking down on him, drawing the fluid out of my spine. And when he pulled the needle out, I shot back into my body, through my body, and out into this void. And the sensation I had was just of floating away in this kind of a matrix. It was and it was nice. It was peaceful. It was very calm. And I was just floating and floating and floating. And then after a period of time, I heard this disembodied voice said, "Do you understand you're dying now?" And I felt like I got the choice. I could just continue the floating, and then I would go ahead and die. But Susan and my daughters were still on the border of Texas, and that part of my brain was thinking, well, this isn't right to die without them being here. And so that sensation of floating away stopped. And then I would come back. It reversed, and I would come back, and I would get to where I felt like I was at a level, and I would rest a little bit. Then I'd come back to another one, and this continued on and on and on, and then I got to where I could actually hear things again.
Well, let me ask you, that choice, was it clear to you at the time that you were making a choice, or was it more like, oh, this is pretty nice, oh, wait, but my wife and kid, no, you know, was it sort of more like a dreamlike, you know, how we kind of like stumble through different experiences and dreams? Or was it really more clear, like, wow, I'm dying now, but I don't want to do that?
Yeah, it was like that. It was very realistic, kind of a sense that I could make a choice here.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and it was very, you know, there was a temptation just to let go and just keep drifting away. But when I chose that, then I would, you know, I came back and I got to hear the voices. And then the next level up, I could see shapes and light again. And when I came to, it was just real frantic in the room, and, you know, people were asking me, do I know who I am and, you know, where I was at, and I couldn't speak. I couldn't get the words to come out from my brain. I knew I wanted to say things to them, but I just couldn't do it. And then I spent, you know, the next days in intensive care, you know, just they would just come in every hour or so and just change all my sheeting because I was, the fever was so high and spiking. And it was at the point where the nurses would actually like look in the door before they would come into the room and say, "Do they know what you have yet?" Because they really weren't quite sure what I had at that point in time. But so then that happened, and then I was released from the hospital, and it was very clear immediately that something had happened to me. I was still so very ill that the brain injury part of it wasn't as clear because I was barely functional. I knew cognitively that, you know, I couldn't think. There was just nothing going on in my head. I could just sit there and just sit in the room and just be staring and not processing anything that I was actually seeing.
Well, that's so interesting, and just like something that Eric had said at the beginning, talking about our friend's kind of brain event and how we identify ourselves so closely with those thought streams and kind of our brains and our thinking. And I just love these kind of events because they so just like disprove Descartes, who I kind of hate about that, you know, I think, therefore I am,
right.
And that you can have this experience outside your brain, and even like you said, like your body consciousness was heightened in the hallucinations, like you could feel everything through your skin, through your bones. You weren't just existing in your brain and in your thoughts, but through the process of your brain having the injury, you were actually forced into another kind of consciousness that we all kind of are in, but since we're so tied up in our thought identification, we can't ever like kind of get into that spot.
And it was really disorienting. I mean, I try to explain that to people. I mean, there's mystics and monks that spend 40 years trying to get to this point where they can just let go of everything. And for me, it happened within an hour.
Mm.
And I wasn't prepared for that. I felt like I was, you know, those next years that I was trying to play catch up because I had lost the sense of my body, actually. And so after I got out of the hospital, it was very disorienting for me because I felt like I was expansive, that there was no boundaries to me. If I was outside, I would just be absolutely overwhelmed. I had to start wearing a hat to kind of make me feel like I had some kind of a sense of a barrier there. And inside, when I was in a room, I would feel like I was actually touching the ceilings. My body would be touching the ceilings and the walls. And when people would come into the room, they would be like within me, within my space.
That reminds me of this wonderful phrase from Alan Watts where he talked about the skin-encapsulated ego.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you lost that skin. And
yeah.
you were exposed. Were you also kind of emotionally exposed? Like, for example, like, you know, in my reality, when somebody walks into the room and they're upset, they're over there outside of me, and so is their upset. But when you were the size of the room or you were expanded in that whole space and then people came in and they were kind of inside you in a way, were you also sort of more closely identifying with their feelings and what they were doing? Was it like almost they were kind of part of you, or was it more just a sort of sense of how you were occupying space?
Well, I actually had to become kind of like a hermit because it's just so intense when people come into your space. And there was no separation. I would have a hard time, you know, there's people that, you know, like you were talking about when people describe this kind of, some kind of spiritual things, people get a little, you know, frightened of that and don't know how to deal with that. But, you know, someone with negative kind of feelings came into my space, that would really overwhelm me. And I actually had to do what's called EMDR trauma therapy. And that was very successful for me to allow people to come closer to me. But the therapist taught me ways to keep their stories away from me. But, you know, I just felt like I was just completely raw, because once you got in beyond my skin barrier, which was extended out from me, it was just raw me.
Right.
And it was extremely intense.
Well, at this point, how much continuity or lack thereof was there in terms of the Dan you were before the dengue fever?
Well, I had lost the brain injury left me, and the high fever left me with big chunks of my long-term memory gone. And then even for those first probably 6 to 7 years after the fever, I didn't have any short-term memory to speak of. So I struggled because I knew cognitively that there was someone who, you know, lived overseas and did work and everything. But at the same time, I didn't have those memories anymore. And so it was just, it's not a good feeling because that's who you are.
That goes into, right, that Buddhist thing a lot of monks talk about is that you are not some of your experiences.
Exactly.
Right, that there's that, then you were like kind of forced to get to the you that transcended your experience.
This compulsion to make art began immediately after I got out of the hospital. And so a sense of reality and unreality, and I couldn't differentiate between my waking time. And but in my dreams, you were describing about those feelings of everything. In my dreams, I would be, you know, the animal.
Mm.
And I could feel every piece of fur on my body. When I would be running through a forest, I could feel the wind on my face and on my whiskers, and I was that animal.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no differentiation between who I was and me as an animal.
So were your dreams during this time as you were in this you know, really the more intense period of trying to reestablish yourself or rediscover yourself or recreate a self, did the dreams themselves change a great deal from the way dreams had been to you before the trauma?
Yeah, definitely. I was always a lucid dreamer. That was something that, you know, carried through my whole life. But these actually were things well above what lucid dreaming is like. And on one level, I would have these kind of mystical kind of dreams where, like, I would be an animal like that. Or I'd fly into a tunnel and come out in another world, and there'd be an ancient figure there, and that would meet up with me and walk with me and talk with me. And the visions ended up being kind of like the basis of a lot of my art, where I do these primitive figures with masks, and their bodies are the universe.
Yeah. So during this time, as you were, how did it work with your... like establishing yourself with your wife and your family in terms of, like, who is this guy? Like, you know, was it like, oh, my God, like, what's happening to him? Is he crazy? Or was there a sense that something, you know, because if you had known, you know, the literature of shamanism and you know, if you're a student of religion like me, I would go, oh, God, look at all these connections. But if you don't have that kind of background, you're like, oh, my God, he's crazy or you're crazy. So how did you kind of navigate through feeling that you were crazy or kind of opening up to your new identity? I mean, is that part of what the art was? Was to make that ability to be this new person you had become?
Well, the art came about just as a pure compulsion. Like, I didn't feel like I had any control over the art. It just kind of happened and started... what happened to me, let me back up a little bit. When my brain started rewiring, what I believed, you know, once I cognitively could kind of think about this, I believed that my brain rewired through my subconscious into a primal me, into a, you know, Paleolithic kind of Dan. And so all of these archetypal images kept pouring out of me. And they just started manifesting themselves as art because I didn't know how else to do that. I'd always worked with my hands as a builder and teaching building technology, and so I, you know, just went with what I knew.
And so, were you able to kind of track scientifically what was happening to you? Like, what did your science brain, what did your geologist brain kind of think about what you were doing when you were compulsively, like, you know, making mountains in your mashed potatoes and stuff like that?
Well, that's I use that example quite a bit because that's what it's like. You know, I do those circular images in my art on. And it's like the you know, doing sculpting the mashed potatoes in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But
right.
Cognitively, my brain didn't catch up to this metaphysical part for quite a long time. I spent probably the first 3 years after the illness sleeping 14, 15 hours a day. And then when I was awake, I had a hard time distinguishing when I was awake and when I was asleep. And I think in my book, I actually talk about that. I had actually convinced myself that I really had died in the hospital and that this was some kind of a just dream state thing that I was doing as I died. Susan, my wife, said, you know, no, that you just went somewhere and you're just not all the way back here. And that's what really helped me is that Susan, my wife, is a therapist, she kind of got that this was helping me. And so I became like this hunter-gatherer. I was wandering through the desert initially, and then when we moved out to Louisville here, I'd go up and down the alleys collecting junk and go to thrift stores and flea markets, and I was filling our basement up with just this huge amount of junk. And once I got this critical mass of junk accumulated, then the dreams just unleashed, and just this torrent of art just started pouring out. And like I said, not having done that, I thought I was going crazy. And Susan found an article in one of her psychology magazines or sociology magazines about visionary art and like outsider art type thing. And I read it, and it kind of gave me the sense, well, maybe I'm not really going crazy. Maybe this is just a function of what happens when you have some kind of a brain injury like this or a fever or a traumatic event.
Wonderful. Well, I'm totally looking forward to diving more into the art and healing process. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking with Dan Rama on Expanding Mind. You can check out his website, Dan, R-H-E-M-A, and he also has a book out called I Close My Eyes to See, which has his art and tells his story. But we'll be right back here after a few messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Dahu, and we're here with the eminent Eric Davis and Dan Rama. We're talking about brain events. There are events that can happen in your brains. Talking a little bit about how you kind of went primitive styled, sort of altered states-ish when you had your fever. And I'm always very interested in that kind of point where people will have these reversions, like a kind of atavistic event where they go primal style and then they can kind of come back out of it in an oscillation, right? So I'm curious, like, was there a moment where you felt like you had kind of made a lot of these art things, maybe like subconsciously, and then kind of came back into your science mind and were able to view them? Like, did the science, Dan, ever really come back, or were you kind of just still always in primal mode?
No, I don't feel like I ever lost my science background. I mean, I still love science. I still love reading about science. That's just a real, you know, a long-term interest of mine. But I just never saw any differentiation between the two.
Right.
You know, I just feel, you know, that, and I can go to the other extent, you know, from between religion, science, and the primal. But I just don't see any distinction. It's all just, it's all the same. It's all the same. And, you know, I do this art. I don't have any kind of I don't have any religious focus for myself.
Mm-hmm.
But all these various religious things just keep finding their way into my art, from, you know, from Kabbalah to Shintoism to Buddhism to Voodoo to Christianity, Judaic pieces, Native American, African American traditional religions, and that's the way the dreams come. Because I don't sit down and say, oh, I'm going to go ahead and do this dream. It just goes. It just happens. And then, you know, sometimes I'll do the pieces, especially the sculptural pieces, and I'm not even quite sure what I'm doing. I just know that this is what it's got to be like. And I'm at the point where, with my life, I mean, when I'm sleeping at night, I'm also in my basement at the same time in my dream, picking pieces out and putting them together in a sculpture.
Mm.
And so then when I get up and I start working on it, and I'm not sure even what it is I'm doing until I'm finished, and then I can set it down and I can look at it and it's like, oh, you know, that's what that is.
Right, so you are able to kind of recognize it after it's complete, or a kind of recognition at least.
Yes, yeah, and I can see things. Like, I didn't have my wife is much more mystical than I ever was, so I didn't have that kind of a background. I didn't have the vocabulary. And then early on, I made a decision because the stuff was just, when I try to explain how it's coming out of me, it's like a vomiting. That's the only way I can describe it, is that I don't make the art every day. I might go 5 months without ever doing a piece of art, but then I start getting anxious, and then the dreams are triggering more and more intently, and then I just got to do it, and then I'll do, you know, 8 paintings and, you know, 12 sculptures in like a 5 or 6 month period, and then I'll stop again. And so it just kind of just like a faucet gets turned on, and I just purge, and when I'm done, it's like, you know, I'm finished, you know, I can stop now. And then I can look back at the pieces, and when I do a lot of shows, and when I'm in the shows, people will say, oh, I know, I recognize this, this is such and such a thing. And, you know, and I can, everybody has their own opinion of things, but then sometimes I look at it and say, oh, yeah, you know, you're right. I just didn't know why I did this. I just did it.
Mm.
But, you know, now for me, you know, I'll do a piece of art and I pop it up on my Chester drawer next to my bed so I can look at it and kind of convince myself that I actually made this thing and kind of get a little sense of being with it. And then because my memory still is not really good, and so after a period of time, I'll actually forget that I made the piece. I know I'd made it, but I just don't have any memory of actually physically doing it. And so for me, it always feels like, I described it as being like the vessel being caught between this creative impulse and the physical manifestation of it.
Well, what's so interesting about the way you're talking about it is that, you know, a lot of artists will use that language, artists who aren't, you know, interested in spirituality, who don't do spiritual art. When they talk about inspiration, they'll talk about it sort of comes, you know, it seems to come from out of me, and then I feel a compulsion or whatever. But for you, it's just, with all of that is so much more intensified. You know, it's so much more sort of naked and raw, the process of whatever inspiration, you know, is across the board. And it's that element of compulsion kind of is sort of what's interesting to me, particularly when you go back and think about what it was initially that started to sort of drive you to these things. And the one question I had was, you know, you could have told your story about, you know, kind of the compulsion to do art in terms of you know, painting you did do or other kinds of work, but I'm really interested in the fact that it involved assemblage of finding objects, broken down objects, trash, things that other people wouldn't see as being valuable, collecting those things and then making work out of that for your sculptures. So I'm curious, like, how have you come to think, or even at the time, how you experienced when you were out in the world finding these things? What was the sense of it? What were these parts of a world that you wanted to put back together? What was it about that assemblage that kind of drove you specifically towards that kind of art?
Well, for me, the one thing that was always kind of bizarre was I was just like blessedly free of any cognitive planning on this. It just I tried to explain it just happened. I didn't think, like, when I started collecting the junk, I mean, when out in the desert, I'd walk and I'd find a rock, and I'd pick the rock up, and I'd pick up a piece of rusted wire. And, you know, we had lived for years internationally in various places, and we lived kind of out of suitcases. We never collected anything. We never had a lot of stuff. But I started just, this compulsion to collect these pieces really was there. And then once, you know, I had that sufficient amount, then that kind of triggered even more dreams. But there was never like a cognitive part of me that's saying, you know, oh, I'm going to do this and kind of represent what's going on here. And I would just do it. It was just like an intuitive thing. And it was so, and that's why I thought I was going crazy, because it wasn't like I was thinking, oh, I'm going to, you know, make some art to make me, you know, feel like I'm getting better. It was like the art was driving me to heal rather than the other way around. The art was coming, and I'd be forced to make it, And then once I had gotten enough art together, a person came by and saw it one day, just kind of as a coincidence, and he said, oh, you know, put this all in one room, and I'm going to bring some people back. And I did, and I ended up with the show. And I wasn't looking to do anything like that. And but after the show, I went to do the show, and I had that the sense of not in my body. So I'm around all these people looking at my art, and they're all touching me and in my story. And I crashed for like 3 months after that. And I told myself, you know, I can't do this. You know, I this isn't for me. And then I had to, I got the therapy, the EMDR trauma therapy, and that enabled me to be around people sufficiently that I could do this.
Wow, that's really interesting. I mean, part of why I asked about the finding bits of junk is because if you look at, you know, visionary artists, this is often something, you know, that a lot of work that people do who are, you know, not trained as artists don't even necessarily think about what they're doing as art per se, but it's really just sort of some kind of making that they do in the context of their lives. And often when they're, you know, motivated by strong visions or you know, extraordinary experiences or obsessions or, you know, that kind of zone of the outsider that now is sort of fetishized as outsider art. But a lot of people are attracted to assemblage and collage. And in fact, a lot of collage, if you look at it in the last 100 years, there's often a lot of interesting kind of spiritual, metaphysical, sort of shamanic themes, because there's something about, to my mind, bringing together the broken bits of the world into a new body. You know, it's different than just, you know, you have a bunch of paint and then you like have a canvas, a blank canvas, and then you create some image out of that. I mean, that's, you know, extraordinary. It's like out of nothing almost. But with building the things and it's the sculptures that you've done are the things that intrigue me the most. I did get that sense too, because in a way, you can see that making the sculpture out of bits of trash, rebuilding a body, is like a literal metaphor for what you're doing for your mind and your soul by creating, you know, the new Dan Rama out of all these fragments and bits and half memories.
It's the Osiris, dismemberment.
And right. This leads me to the question to that extraordinary. I think it's a dream you describe in your book where you talk about seeing the world from the perspective of the artwork.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell that tale. It's really...
Well, one of the things with my art, like the paintings that I do a lot of cave paintings and with openings and things. And so in my dream states a lot, I'll actually fly into my paintings at night and come out somewhere else. But the one night I had done a piece that I called Shaman, and it's a sculptural piece on a board. And the night I finished that, I found myself inside the piece of art and looking out through the wire that made up the head and the glass, and I could tilt that down and look down at my body, and it was the wood and the metal that I used to put the pieces together. And that's when cognitively I understand is that, you know, that I was the piece of art. And I had just recently, this was after that experience, but I had read The Mind in the Cave, this a book by David Lewis Williams about the Paleolithic people and the cave art, and, you know, understood initially back, you know, the early part of the Paleolithic, the body was the piece of art, and you paint your body. You painted your body, and your body became that piece of art representing that worldview. And I think that's what I might have been trying to explain in that piece, is that, you know, that in my Paleolithic mind that I have, that I am the piece of art. That because I always struggled with calling myself an artist, because I don't doodle, you know, I don't draw. I mean, I can't draw like regular artists can draw. I mean, I can do the things that I do, my paintings, but they're very primal, very primitive.
Well, I mean, that really speaks to the, I love throwing in etymologies, and the etymology of the word art, and this is very striking, science means to cut, to separate, to take things apart. Mm-hmm. And art means to bring back together. The word art literally means to reassemble and bring things back together. So a lot of people do have this idea that art is rendering, right, or some kind of perfect depiction, but it is exactly the process that you went through is the most precise definition of what art is.
Oh, that's too much. I didn't realize that at all.
Yeah.
You know, another thing that this is also a kind of classic Maja riff on that she brings up on the show, that also that dream made me think of, was in some of these, you know, traditional shamanic accounts that you'll find in the Eliade lore and the anthropology, you know, of course, there's this classic experience of being dismembered, you know, almost like your experience when you were in the hospital room, where, you know, these sort of, you know, outside creatures or spirits,
yeah,
or demons break down your body, but then they rebuild it. Mm-hmm. And they often rebuild it, or it gets rebuilt through some kind of you know, non-organic material. Like there's often metal or crystals. And there's a kind of, like, rebuilding of the shaman's body through things that kind of are as much art materials as they are living materials.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really came back to me when I read your thing about how after these kinds of traumas, which are sort of both physical and spiritual and, you know, everything, that rebuilding is as much about crafting as it is about growing again. You know, it's not just the pure force of life, it's also a kind of imaginative craft, you know, something where you do with these materials. Well, now I'm kind of curious, since you've been doing this for a while, I mean, this is we've been in the, you know, Dan Rayma 2 world for a while, how is the process changing? How is it, you know, is it becoming more integrated? Are you more so aware of the artistic practice, or does it still happen with this kind of, you know, explosions and intense dreams? Is it sort of changing as you go through the years?
Well, you know, as I've healed cognitively, as I've healed, and I, you know, like I said, I did therapy and stuff too to help me. As I've healed from the brain injury, I feel like I have a better handle on things. You know, I still don't get out a lot. I still tend to be alone. I still have anxiety issues. You know, I went from a guy who could travel the world if you gave me a ticket, I was gone, to a person who, when I leave my house and my studio, my anxiety level goes up. But you know, the dreams are still there. You know, I'm working on two pieces of art right now that I worked on this morning. I had a little burst maybe 2 months ago and did like 7 sculptures. So that still happens. I just the dreams. You know, I was having my flying dreams like 3 nights ago, you know, so that just all still happens, but. Because I've actually healed over the years, I would, for example, I, you know, back when I was really still recuperating, I would loop at night, and I would have these real trauma-related dreams where I was like lying on a city street in the rain, and someone was shooting me in the head, and that would happen to me, and I would just dream this over and over and over again, and couldn't get out of those loops, and then at that point, I was just finally coming to grips with maybe this is what my life will be. You know, I'll do this art stuff, because people responded to it, which kind of surprised me, because I was still trying to search, you know, who I was, and I just realized that I couldn't function very well, because if I do a show, all these people come in my space, I crash, and it would just be a cycle like that.
And it's interesting, too, like what you, I mean, in my opinion, I don't know, would not want to do would be then to try to re-seek your identity in that thing you're doing to try to recover from losing your identity, right?
It was a difficult choice, it was a grieving process. It was like, but then there came a point where I realized in order for me to heal, I had to let go of the old Dan. And so I went to this therapist that did this trauma therapy, and because I wasn't sleeping, I was going without sleep for so long, and she said, I can do this, I can help you, I can take this away. And then I started having the thoughts, well, if I stop doing this and if I get better and this stops, then what do I do? Because I don't know who I am. And she said, no. If you want to do this art, it will get better because you're not going to be dealing with that trauma part of it anymore, you know, as much. And so, and she was right. I mean, it really helped the art. I was able to do much more. And as you know, just by doing things, you tend to make differences in it. You know, the first paintings I did are very different from the ones I do now, but they were trying to do the same thing.
And do you feel any kind of like fear for what will happen if there comes a moment where you just don't feel like making the art anymore? Because I mean, it seems like that whole process, right, that's the spiritual journey, and that so many people talk about that you do. You have the crisis, you make the art, you do the process going through this identity, and then eventually, I mean, if all goes according to the story, you reach the point where that becomes no longer necessary, right? And then you have the formulation of your whole self, of your whole identity that kind of exists outside of all of those things. Do you kind of feel like you might reach that point eventually, or are you not even like kind of thinking about that?
No, I don't. You know, there's been a couple times that I've thought to myself, well, what if this stops? You know, but right now there is no line between me and the art. It's just me. And,
right.
And so I don't have a differentiation. I mean, at some point it could come to be that, but. You know, I just still do the art. I just can't stop it. and I'm, you know, I have healed a lot, but I mean, I still have a lot of other issues, you know, related to this. You know, verbally, I'm fine. Cognitively, I have my moments still. I'm deaf on one side from the illnesses. I, you know, like I said, I still struggle with being around crowds and around a lot of people. And, but, you know, I've learned little techniques, like, you know, after this radio interview, I'll probably have to take something and knock myself out just because of the intensity of it. And when I do these talks, you know, it's still raw enough for me that it just really kind of can become overwhelming. I did a show in Joshua Tree, California, last December and January, and during the opening night, I had some people there that know me that were there, and you know, they described it as like an altar call, because in my shows people feel like they have now the opportunity to say that, you know, when I was 12 years old I drowned and I had a near-death experience, and you know, and then they, you know, tell me all these things, and you know, it's not necessarily things that I want to hear because it's so intense for me, but there's a value in what I do, and that value is to allow other people who have had some kind of experience to verbalize it, that they, you know, when they've never done that before.
That's a wonderful way of looking at it. I just want to bring up one more reflection here. I mean, we've got about 5 minutes left, is that I think a different kind of person who had gone through the experiences you did, a lot of what they would be talking about, even if they were creating the art that you were doing, would be about the world that they saw. You know, they would say, oh my God, there's this spiritual world and there are all these entities and this is what's going to happen and this is what happens when you die, and you know, da da da. They would have a lot of sort of, they would build a world view out of these experiences, these intense dreams and whatever. They'd say, oh, this is what these guys were doing and it's magical and it's this and that. And what I hear from you is that while you know, clearly live in a different world and have levels of experience, different levels of things that most people don't, that at the core of it for you, it's art. It's making art. It's not a belief system. It's not a, you know, a religious way of looking at the world, a new religious way of looking at the world. It's really a kind of process, and it's a process where the trauma is still part of what's going on. It's not like, oh, I had this horrible experience and now I've delivered to this new world. It's that it's an ongoing thing, and I think that's partly what people are responding to. They're saying, oh, he's not saying that we have to believe X or Y. He's saying that out of these traumas that all of us have to different degrees, art can come out that has that greater intensity, that greater sense of meaning, but without necessarily becoming a belief system.
Yeah, well, when Maja was saying earlier about the science part, I think maybe this is where this comes in. it became clear to me once I started getting better and I started doing the art. At one point, I thought, "Oh my gosh, this is how religions get started." You know? This is exactly, I mean, because everything that was going through my head, all these metaphysical thoughts, all this, and that frightened me, and it frightened me because, you know, I didn't want to be that person. Partly because that wasn't what I was seeking; it just kind of happened to me, and then the other part was just, you know, if I could tell people that this is what they have to believe, you know, then someone else has a different experience and they can tell people that this is what they have to believe. And it's just, that really, really kind of frightened me. And I thought, no, and that for years I would never even read anything about mystical experiences. I wouldn't read about shamanism. People would give me books and I would tell them, no, I just want to do what I do. And partly is because I was so ill with the brain injury that I couldn't handle anything more than that. And it was a terrifying thought for me that, you know, that this could potentially, I could become a cult leader. You know, this guy with this brain injury could be out there telling people what to do. And
well, the
like,
beautiful thing that, you know, I think kind of comes out of it when people can get past that fear and dogma and kind of thing where they do use it to power trip on other people and become cult leaders is your experience in the art shows, where what it does provide is an opening for people to come together through suffering. And that is the empathy and the sympathy, which should be where all religion comes from, right?
And that's sufficient for me.
Exactly, exactly. So it's about, and that's how the shaman heals, is through sympathy. You have someone else that had an experience similar to yours, and you experience something similar to maybe something thousands of people throughout history have, and that is what sympathetically ties you to the universe and to history. So that's the awesome thing that comes out of it.
Well, and the nice thing for me was, because it didn't feel like I was doing it, I didn't have to have an ego involved in it. It was just happening through me, and I just felt like I wasn't really doing this stuff, and so I never got a chance to develop what probably you normally would do, would be to develop an ego around what you're doing, because I feel like this could leave me just as easily as it came to me, and you know, so I'll just do what I do, and you know, and just, you know, I'll be along for the ride with everyone else.
That's great. Well, we're going to have to wind things up here. I want to mention again, you can go to Dan Rhema, rhema.com, and also check out the book, I Close My Eyes to See. Dan has some children's books as well, but I Close My Eyes to See, it's just available wherever, Dan?
It's an e-book, and so it's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and on iTunes right now.
Great, great. And then do you have any shows coming up?
Yeah, I have a show here in Louisville. It's a show called Envision, and it's a show dealing with people who have visual issues, and so they asked me to be part because I just see differently.
Okay, great. We'll have to wrap up there. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you.
All right, for me and Maja, keep your minds open.